All right. This meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy will come to order. It is way too early in the morning for this.
You're here.
It's about 7:07. We are here on Wednesday, the 12th, 2012, in the Butchervich meeting room. I'll start off with thanking everybody for their patience, for everyone's willingness to move this to this early of the time and allow the House to take the opportunity yesterday to spend some time grieving the loss of our friend. It's very much appreciated, both from my stance and from, I'm sure, many of the other members of the House, but also we appreciate the time and energy that our presenters also have taken, as they had other plans and they've rearranged for this. So thank you for it. I think this is a very important topic, and we need to spend the time appropriately. Please make sure that everyone's cell phones are turned off, and make sure that they do not interfere with any of the electronics. Today we have Representative Tuck, Representative Lynn, Representative Peterson, Representative Sadler, my co-chair, Representative Foster, and myself, Representative Pruitt, all here. And we will be having a presentation on the short and long-term stability and reliability of the gas in Cook Inlet. Starting off, we have a presentation by Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska and their Cook Inlet gas supply study. I won't go into the details of kind of the history of it. I believe their presentation does some of that, tells us kind of the history of the actual presentation, and will help us give a reason for why they did it, as well as the kind of what's new in their world and why this is relevant at this point in time. If we could have Tom Walsh from PRA, if he is here. And it looks like he may not yet be here. So what we'll do is, since he's not here yet, we're going to go ahead and, if DNR is available, we'll go ahead and jump to DNR. And that was kind of our concern, is that he might not be here. DNR also has some of the details. Everyone should have their Cook Inlet activity and natural resource update. That looks like everyone does. So with that, we appreciate you guys being here. And as always, please state your names and affiliations for the record and go ahead and present. The intent is that we'll spend about an hour on this. Of course, we have to be on the floor at 9. I do understand that there are several members that need to leave at about 8 o'clock. They'll need to step aside for about 20, 30 minutes for another committee. Please feel free to do that. Otherwise, let's make this a dialogue with the, if that's okay with the presenters. But obviously, as we adjust for time, I'll make sure that we try to control some of the questions, the amount of questions, so that we can get through what we need to. So, gentlemen, if you would, please.
Very good. My name is Paul Decker. I'm a petroleum geologist with the Division of Oil and Gas in Anchorage in the Resource Evaluation Group.
And for the record, my name is Bob Swenson. I'm the state geologist and the director of the State Geological and Geophysical Survey.
So we thank you for hearing the testimony today. What we'd like to do would be to begin with a very brief overview, the highest points of a couple of natural gas studies that we conducted within the Division of Oil and Gas over the last couple of years, and then move on to some of the Cook Inlet exploration activity and what we see as positive indications for long-term potential of the Cook Inlet Basin. So again, just very high points here. We did two studies. The first we wrapped up at the very end of 2009. The next we conducted throughout 2011. In the first, we took an engineering and geological approach and integrated those two disciplines to determine how much gas remains in the 28 gas fields in Cook Inlet, the 28 known producing gas fields in the inlet. And so the emphasis there was on what we call reserves and some of the gas that we would more likely characterize as potentially recoverable resource. And we'll talk about definitions here in a bit. We also provided some examples in that studies of undeveloped gas leads that had been penetrated by previous drilling, but never followed up on. So we would view that as maybe suspect potential resource. You know, it's something that you can identify, but not necessarily high potential because no one has gone after it after so many years. We did not in that study attempt to include an estimate of the undiscovered resources in the basin. So that's U.S. Geological Survey's domain, and they do that quite well, and Bob will speak to some of their numbers. In the 2011 study, what we did there was follow up on the commerciality aspect. If we identified a bunch of gas in the first study, we wanted to know how likely is it that some of that gas would be able to come to market and to meet the existing demand requirements. Could that be done at a reasonable rate of return for the investors? And so to do that, we generated dozens of very specific projects or development scenarios based on, again, the geology and the engineering, actual hard data from these fields, looking for infill drilling locations or potential locations based on how depleted the reservoirs are, looking at what operating pressure the fields have been depleted to and whether compression additions might be able to boost that compression or boost that ultimate recovery, that sort of scenario. And so in the end, we ended up assigning probabilities to our various scenarios and using Monte Carlo simulation to model the commerciality and production outcomes. So this is the sort of money slide, if you will, for the first study in 2009. And what we've tried to do here is indicate in the various tranches of reserves that are in the forecast part, you know, from 2010 forward, different volumes of gas that we can identify with the various types of geological and engineering analyses that we conducted. So the very first tranche, what's labeled decline curve analysis reserves, this would be sort of the gold standard, the most conservative volume that you can identify in communication with the existing wells in those fields. And so in doing that, we identified, about 860 billion cubic feet of gas remaining in the basin. Not in the basin, but remaining in communication with existing wells throughout the basin. And I think PRA, when they testify, you'll see that they came up with a very similar number using that same approach. But then we went on and we went further steps, and we said, let's look at another engineering methodology, material balance analysis. And what that does is actually it sees more gas that has been at some time during the history of those fields in communication with the producing wells. And so an example of some of that gas that might not be seen in the decline curve analysis would be gas in a completion string that has had to be shut in because maybe a few of the perforations began to make water. So because of the details of how some of those wells are completed, it's not possible to just remediate the watering out perforations. You have to shut in an entire production string. And so some of that gas that could have been recovered through that production string would show up in this orange tranche of material balance reserves. And then the yellow and green tranches represent basically what the geologists can identify that the engineers don't see in the producing wells. And so the way that works is looking at well logs, identifying zones from the petrological signature there, or petrophysical signature in the well logs, and identifying what we can confidently assign to the pay category, mapping that up and estimating the volumes in the reservoir that are unperforated, for example, or that we can assume are present in between wells that the existing wells don't see. And the yellow tranche, a much bigger tranche, is similar to that, but it's what we would consider less confident identification of pay on the well logs. And so because we're far less confident of that sort of resource, we discounted it by 50%. What you see here is actually 50% risked. So anyway, those two tranches, green and yellow, are based on geological analysis. And then finally, exploration leads. These are the prospects that have been drilled in the past, where the wells going through may have seen gas shows, but they decided not to go ahead and try and monetize that for whatever reason. Most likely, in most of those cases, they were actually seeking oil, and they, at the time, didn't choose to complete the well as a gas producer. So We'll talk about those a little bit in the second study. Oops, let's go this way.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looks like whichever model you look like, looks like the decline curves are pretty much the same. So it just depends on how much we're finding to push it out, but that decline curve is always going to be fairly consistent. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I understand your point. The rate of decline, this sort of hyperbolic-looking decline, that's actually more like a log linear decline. But the point is, yes, the rate of fall-off is determined by the rate of consumption. So, and an important thing to keep in mind is that these are shown as sequential tranches, but that's not in reality how this would play out. We would hope to see people going out there and exploring for some of the green, yellow, and gray, as well as producing from the red and orange all at the same time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Please continue.
Thanks. So then in the second study, again, we took a different approach. What we were after here had to do with commerciality. How commercial were these projects, and how much could we recover with a commercial filter applied? So what we did there was to say, okay, if we have a lot of different gas out there and these different mechanisms that we can identify, let's actually go and design specific projects based on engineering data and geological information. And here we're breaking out the resources in a different way. This is by the sort of investment project that might actually return those resources. So as you see here, the existing wells, where we don't need capital investment, we just need to maintain those wells and keep them running, we have a mean estimate of about 660 BCF that should be able to be recovered there. This is before the commercial filtering. This is just what we identified as the mean estimate for those projects. The orange tranche in this study represented resources, the mean estimate again of what we thought we could recover with compression additions. And then once we go to things like the material balance and the geological analysis, those are showing up in this graph in the green bar. This is where we need new investment. We need to drill new wells or add perforations or work over older wells to get to these kinds of reserves. And then finally, the 248, that represents some of these exploration leads, so to speak, which in reality are small, high-risk, previously drilled prospects. And then, so this is what it looked like as far as our mean case for what we could specifically identify with concrete projects for going to get those before we ran the commercial analysis. So to jump just to the very end of that story, the conclusions of that 2011 study were that the basin is capable, given sufficient investment, of continuing to supply the regional natural gas needs until about 2018 or 2020 with attractive rates of return that you would think would spur the investment necessary to get that gas. So, and that's without considering rank exploration. Clearly, going out and finding large fields with new exploration would extend that time frame farther out into the future. So the question then becomes, if it models out as being a commercial venture, why do we not see more investment? Why do we not see people going out and finding more gas and bringing more gas online? And I think the answer to that question really has a lot to do with the unusual nature of the Cook Inlet gas market. It's a very unusual market in that it's not attached to the spot market and that it has these huge seasonal swings in demand. If we look at this next slide, what you see here is the huge difference between wintertime and summertime demand. And in particular, the peak days of the winter and the coldest days of winter when the demand can be nearly twice what it is on the average basis. So we believe, just returning to the last paragraph here, that natural gas storage will play an increasingly important role in commercial deliverability and meeting the peak deliverability in the basin and spurring investment to make that happen in this basin. So moving on to the gas storage picture, what we see in the inlet right now are six approved gas storage projects. The three on the right there in the bolder sort of yellow color represent the ones that have been online for some time, the larger one being the Marathon Kenai Pool 6 storage that had about 6 billion cubic feet of storage capacity and about 60 million cubic feet of deliverability, 60 million cubic feet per day of deliverability into the gas line system. The other ones were smaller. And now what we're seeing in the lower left there is the SINGSA project nearby there at Cannery Loop coming online. I believe that they're actually beginning to store gas right now as we speak. And so that's the biggest project in the basin, a very welcome addition. It'll bring an additional 11 billion cubic feet of capacity and 150 million cubic feet per day of deliverability. So we really feel like that's a big step in the right direction. And when you add up that deliverability, it gets a long ways towards tempering the ability to meet those seasonal swings. And, of course, it'll give the producers a place to sell their gas year-round. They won't have to wait for the coldest days of the winter to try and return investment on their wells. So, moving on, some of the activity in the basin and some of the encouraging signs that we see. Our 2011 lease sale in June was a big success, a great success, one of the best we've seen in the inlet. We sold over 100 tracts there, nearly, over 575,000 acres, and parted $11 million to the state that day. We did something a little different there with the Cosmopolitan. This is not really germane to this presentation, so I'll just move on. But we did something a little bit unusual there with Cosmo to try and get it developed. And Apache ended up being the largest bidder in the sale by far. They spent about $9 million that day. And they ended up picking up the light blue, kind of looks like light greenish blue on the screen. So a lot of different tracks throughout the basin gives them an enviable position for exploring the basin. So this is our activity map. You see a lot of the companies listed there on the right-hand side. I'll just hit some of the high points in the interest of time. Apache is now shooting 3D nodal seismics. That's a new technology for the inlet. Should get very good 3D seismic data. And they are moving on, planning two wells later this year, one on the east side and one on the west side. Hillcorp is now operating the former Unocal Chevron assets. They're not doing much exploration that we know of, but what they are doing is bringing on the Nikolaevsk unit, we believe, with the construction of a pipeline that should come on next year, done by Homer. Fury, that's the successor to the former Escapeda company. Escapeda brought in the Spartan 151 jackup drilling rig, and they are expected to resume drilling at their Kitchen Lights unit here within the next couple of weeks, we hope. They recently reduced their estimate of how much gas that KLU number one well actually found. They reduced that number by close to 80%. I think it's prudent to wait until they actually have production data or test data to make a more refined estimate. Buccaneer had some success there at Kenai Loop, proving up about 30 billion cubic feet of reserves in their first well. And then their second well was a dry hole, so it's speaking to some of the inherent uncertainty in this geologic setting. That well was actually, the reservoir was depleted by the nearby Cannery Loop production. But they're planning to bring the ADA-subsidized Endeavor jackup into the basin this summer, and we hope to see one or two wells drilled offshore from that rig this year. Nordak, they've had success at Shadura, at least enough to go and say that they're permitting two more wells and development roads and pads. They're also permitting a well on the west side, the Tiger Eye Prospect, on shore near the West Foreland. We expect to see that drilled this year. And then if you go through the list, Anchor Point is the group that's done some recompletions and some new drilling down at the Anchor, or the North Fork field. It's Armstrong and partners. So that gas is now on production through a new 7.5-mile pipeline to Anchor Point. Cook Inlet Energy has restarted several wells on the west side, bringing some platforms into production. They're also bringing in a custom rig. And Siri and Link are looking at underground coal gasification, as well as some other opportunities. And we've already mentioned the gas storage. So a long list of encouraging signs for this year and into the future. I think you've all seen the jackup. That's as it arrived in the basin last summer. Okay, let's just think about exploration drilling through time. This is shading. It's got both North Slope and Cook Inlet, so I'm trying to emphasize the Cook Inlet in the red there. Of course, a lot of activity back in the 1960s, and it's gone up and down through time. We saw sort of a recent increase in drilling between about 2002 and 2005. Then it's kind of tapered off a few years ago, but now we're looking at an upswing again. So between 2008 And in the present, we're looking at a nice uptick. The circle there at the right edge of the graph reflects that we expect to see 8 to 10 exploration wells completed in Cook Inlet this year. So we'll update that number when the year is over.
Can you help me understand? What created that spike in the early 2000s here?
You know, I can't speak to that for certain, but I'm imagining Bob will hazard a guess here.
Back in the early 2000s, we saw a significant effort in looking at mispay opportunities. A lot of wells were drilled on the Kenai Peninsula, Deep Creek, Anchor Point area, looking at what they thought was bypass pay, and also a lot of exploration on near the Kenai gas field and offshore in the on the Clam Gulch structure near Nikiski.
Okay.
If we look at a similar graph for development wells, again, it lagged a little bit after the exploration wells, but a lot of development drilling in the late 60s, then up and down a few time. And I think what we saw there here, or see there, is a tapering off of development drilling activity in the last few years. It's not unlike we've seen in the past, but I think it has to do with uncertainty as to whether there's going to be additional capacity in the market so that companies can continue to produce their wells year-round. And again, I think that's where demonstrating storage capacity is absolutely key for this basin. Let's spend just a couple minutes on definitions here. The difference in resources and reserves is often lost on a lot of people, and I myself slip up and use the wrong word sometimes, but it's an incredibly important concept to understand. So let's talk first about resources in specific undiscovered, technically recoverable resource. That's a mouthful, but that's exactly what the U.S. Geological Survey estimates represent. It is just as the name sounds, or the phrase would indicate. It's oil and gas that's only estimated to exist in accumulations that have never been found by drilling. So it's really a crystal ball exercise of trying to imagine what's down there without actually having proof that it exists. But if it's found, we believe it could be potentially produced using the current technology and industry practices. So that's the technically recoverable part. Only an unknown fraction of that category of a resource would ever be commercial to find, develop, and produce. And so sometimes it's called prospective resources because it doesn't occur in gas fields or oil fields. It occurs in prospects. The ideas about where to go look for oil and gas. So it's a prospective resource.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so do you think the tax incentives that the state has provided will make more companies give them the incentive to go out and look for some of these prospective resources?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I do believe that's what we're going to see, and I think it has been a big part of why we see the jackup rig in the inlet now, and why another company has made plans to bring another jackup into the basin. So I do think the incentives promote exploration for the prospective resource, yes.
All right, thank you.
Moving on, proved.
Representative Tuck, pardon me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that a lot of the Cook Inlet exploration was actually looking for oil, but gas was a byproduct. And with the new incentives that we have now at the state of Alaska, we actually now for the first time are having explorers look for gas. And so on the slide that you had previously on slide 9, you listed all those different companies now that are exploring for gas, apparently. How many of those have been just recently in the past 5 years?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, without going back and counting, I'd say most of them. There's a lot of independents that have come into the basin in the last few years, and the role of the major producers that have been here for a long time has decreased in exploration.
Okay, and may I follow up? And those legacy companies that were falling back, was that because they're no longer looking for oil and they're not interested in exploring for gas?
Through the chair, I believe part of the answer with that may lie in the fact that Cook Inlet for them is not as material an investment or a rate of return since they're a larger company, they're probably focusing a lot of their activity elsewhere in the world where they believe that they may be able to have larger projects that are more material to their balance sheets.
Okay.
That's at least a part of the answer to that question. There may be other issues as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So moving on, we are going to have to hurry. Approved reserves, in contrast, are oil and gas. This is according to the SEC, who monitors bookings of reserves. Oil and gas, which by analysis of the engineering and geological data, can be estimated with reasonable certainty to be economically producible. So economic and known. Okay, so those are very, very different from the first category of undiscovered resource. So sometimes we apply a 90% certainty of meeting or exceeding the quoted value of resource there, reserves.
Now, and economic could mean many different things, correct? It could mean they could make, I'm just making numbers up, a penny an MCF to a dollar an MCF. It can mean a lot of different things.
That's right, Mr. Chair. And the answer is that proved reserves are those reserves that you're pretty sure are going to come out of the ground because the producers want it out of the ground. And proved developed reserves are one step higher. They're proved reserves that can be expected to be recovered through the existing wells without, you know, significant new investment. So that's really what we see with decline curve analysis. Moving on, we'll show you the different categories here and what it takes to get from the bottom of this chart to the top of the chart, from prospective to reserves. The keys here are exploration success and commercial validation. First, you have to shoot the seismic data and map a prospect. Once you have a prospect, you can assign resources to it, prospective resource. Then you have to get the land. You have to get a lease to drill on. Then you have to drill the well. And if you're lucky enough 10 or 20% of the time, perhaps, to make a discovery, then you have a discovery. So you're no longer in prospective resource. You're in what's called contingent resource. You know it's there, but you don't know yet if it's going to be commercially viable. And so you do additional drilling, you refine your model, refine your uncertainty. And finally, you go to the project sanction stage, where you're doing all the detailed engineering and cost analysis, the environmental, the permitting. You're getting board or investor approval at this stage. And at that point, you've demonstrated that you believe it's commercial, and you can elevate that resource into the reserves category. And finally, once it's developed, you've laid the gravel, you've built the facilities and so forth, and you've drilled the wells, then you're at proven developed reserves. So very different categories.
Representative Sadler?
Just real briefly, that's a wonderful chart. I'm just trying to find it, couldn't have it. If you could leave a copy of this with us before you take off, it'd be great.
Yeah, through the chair. This same slide was moved to the front of the pack, but it's also in the back of the pack, and you'll see that. So, and at this point, I'll turn it over to Bob Swenson to review exploration activity and resource, prospective resource potential.
Thank you, Bob. Please put your name back on the record.
For the record, my name is Bob Swenson. I'm the state geologist and director of the State Geological and Geophysical Survey. What I'd like to move to now is to talk to the technically recoverable resource in the basin that's been estimated primarily through the USGS. They have worked significantly with the state. We've worked with them for 5 years on different projects across the entire basin to help them understand the geology in the basin so they could perform this analysis. I think one of the key things we should look at first is to talk specifically about the statistics of exploration in the basin through time. As Representative Tuck pointed out, 85% of the gas discovered was discovered during the early exploration cycle, during that cycle of exploration in the 1960s. In 1968, we saw that dramatic decrease in the amount of drilling, and of course that was the same time that Prudhoe Bay was discovered, and a lot of the activity went north. All of that gas, probably 95% of it, was found while drilling for oil. They were looking for deep oil, and they hit shallower gas. During that effort, only structural traps were actually being prospected and drilled. Early 1960s seismic, the quality of that seismic is relatively poor, certainly in comparison with today's standard of seismic data. I'll show you a couple seismic lines where these things are really difficult to miss. Nearly one in 10 fields is greater than 2 trillion cubic feet of gas. That's a very, very unusual statistic, and we'll be talking about that here in a bit more. Four of the largest fields have 86% of the current reserves, and that's the known reserves. That's not talking about what we will be referring to in the technically recoverable resource. And then finally, that field size distribution, and we'll talk a bit more about this. It's a very important look at any basin across the globe, but it really does lack the size discoveries between 300 BCF and 1.3 TCF, and we'll be talking more to that when we look at the work that was done by USGS. So moving directly to that, and Paul has very well explained the difference between reserves and resources, but it's, again, I will go over just very briefly. The work that was done by the USGS is identifying the undiscovered technically recoverable oil and gas. It does not have an economic filter on it. So in other words, the numbers that they produce do not mean to say that all of that resource, if it was found, could be produced. There has to be an economic filter, and some portion of that amount, of course, is available or could be available for production into the system. However, another very important part, and we'll be talking about this in the next couple of slides, is that these are often talked about in a mean value or an arithmetic mean of a distribution. And so what's really important, I've testified many, many times on this, is to look at what the range of possibilities are and what that means and how that range fits into it. In fact, the USGS is now changing on how they report these numbers and including the range of possibilities. But for the Cook Inlet Basin, we won't be talking specifically about the oil, but they had an arithmetic mean of their probabilistic distribution of about 600 million barrels of oil, and that's in two assessment units. And this is going to be an important part of this discussion as well. The tertiary sandstone, that's where all of the current oil production in the basin comes out of. That's the rock package that all current oil comes from as a tertiary. And they also felt that given the data, that the mean of 227 million barrels could be found in the Mesozoic. And, of course, that's what we're hearing from companies like Apache that are looking at that Mesozoic play and doing exploration for oil in that deeper part of the section. And moving to the gas, there were four assessment units. First, the tertiary sandstone play, and that, again, is where all of the current gas is being produced from, is the tertiary sandstone. They felt they calculated a mean of 2.2 trillion cubic feet. And in the Mesozoic, 1.5 trillion cubic feet. However, there is no production from that currently.
And then, you said 2.2. The slide says 12.2. Is that a misstatement or typo?
Yeah, Representative Souter, through the chair, thank you very much. That was a misstatement. It's 12.2. I think you jumped a bit when I said that too, Paul. Sorry. And then moving on to the unconventional, these are the two conventional assessment units, so the conventional type production. And the unconventional in the Mesozoic tight sand plays, in other words, a unconventional type play, they felt at 600 BCF for a mean value. And then finally, the tertiary coal bed play, 4.7 TCF. But as I mentioned earlier, I think it's very, very important that you dig deeper into these numbers and you understand what those numbers mean. And so this chart is very, very busy, and I've highlighted some of the key aspects here. The assessment unit, the very top tertiary sandstone oil and gas assessment unit. And if you go over to the column labeled gas, you'll see underneath that F95, F50, F5, and mean. And that is the probabilistic distribution that they came up with in this analysis. The important thing to remember here, you can see the mean of the 11.992 for that assessment unit. However, the range that they had was between 2.8 TCF per trillion cubic feet and 24.4 trillion cubic feet. And what the F95 and F5 numbers refer to is the F95 number, the 2.8 trillion cubic feet. There's a 95% chance that the amount of undiscovered resource in the basin in this unit is greater than that number. That's what that F95 means. If you move over to the F5 number, which is 24.4, there's only a 5% chance that the resource numbers or the resource undiscovered resource in the basin is greater than that number. And another important point to look at when you see these types of numbers is what that range is. If that range is very, very narrow around the mean, that means that you have a tremendous amount of information. You have a lot of 3D seismic data. You have lots and lots and lots of wells. And so you have a relatively good understanding of what's going on. The broader that range is, the less that analysis understands about the basin. So that's another key aspect to look at. So when you hear this number talked about, we've heard a lot about it, this 19.037 TCF or 19 TCF, you have to understand that there's many, many different units, assessment units that go into that number, as well as that there's a range around that mean that represents the P95 and P5 numbers.
Can I ask, this is, and it's probably important to make sure we clarify, recoverable is a whole lot different than economical, correct? We may have 19, potentially, the mean might be 19 TCF, but we have to make sure that we're clear that it doesn't necessarily mean that that's 19 TCF that makes sense, that someone's going to say, let's jump on, we want to get. A portion of that will be, but not necessarily on 19. Is that correct assessment of that?
Chairman Pruitt, that's, and thank you very much for pointing that out. That is one of the key aspects of this, and that has to be understood, is that this represents the technically recoverable resource, the potential. It does not represent what you will, over many, many, many years of exploration, find. It is, if you had, and excuse me for the analogy here, but if you had X-ray glasses and you were able to look underground and you were able to see every reservoir in the entire basin, that number represents that. Now, whether it's economic, whether you have access to it, that's a whole different story, and that number will be some portion of that 19. So thanks for clarifying that.
Thank you for that. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But to go back up to the under the 95, P95 column where it says 2836, so that's 2.8 trillion cubed. There's a 95% chance that there's 2.8 trillion cubic feet. Am I reading that right?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, that is correct.
And at our current rate of usage, how many years would that last? 20?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, I don't think I can do the math that quick in my head. 90 BCF a year is what the current demand is. And so,
Close to 30.
Yep.
All right. Thank you.
Move on.
Please.
Okay, one of the key aspects of this is that these numbers aren't pulled out of the air. There's a tremendous amount of work that goes into this with these analyses. The USGS does do these analyses all over the globe, and they have a full team that works in many, many basins around the globe. But on this slide just shows you some of the assessment inputs that go in. The box up to the top left there's a lot of fields in this basin, and so they're able to use the data that's garnered from those fields for input. There's a fair amount of seismic data that's input into the system. Up on the top right, a significant amount of outcrop, looking at the rocks, understanding what the reservoir distributions are, also go into that, as well as detailed analyses on these rocks. You can see thin sections and porosity permeability type calculations, and stratigraphic understanding, the understanding of how these rocks fit together and what the basin history is. And then finally, when this is all put together, when the models are all done, USGS has a very robust global database that they make comparisons to. When they see this, they look at other basins around the world that may have had a lot more exploration and they know a lot more about the basin, and they say, does this make sense? And so they're able to compare with that. And so it's not numbers that are just pulled out of there. There's actually a fair amount of work that goes into it. One of the key aspects, and I think this is a very, very important slide. This is an example slide, but one of the key aspects of what comes out of this analysis is the distribution of field sizes in their model. And so how many fields of what size that makes up that total resource base that they're estimating?
Representative Sadler has a question for
you. Mm-hmm. Bob, real quick, the previous chart talks about conventional oil and gas resources and continuous oil and gas resources.
Yes.
What's continuous mean?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, a continuous resource is exactly what we're seeing in the lower 48, the shale gas plays and the shale oil plays. And so instead of having a reservoir to oil that's migrated into a reservoir, a continuous play means that you're developing shale. Oh, yes. And Paul also pointed out that that's the same type of play with for coal bed methane. So in other words, the hydrocarbon is actually in place where it was generated. Okay, back to this slide. Very, very key part of the study is what the field sizes you'd expect to see. And this is generated from these models, and they can make comparisons with the other basins that have been developed near the end. And it shows how many different size, all the different size fields along the bottom, the x-axis, and the y is how many of those fields you will see. And as you can see here, most of the fields that you are going to find are going to be very small in comparison. You'll only see the very, very big fields in just a very, very few cases. And we see that over and over and over again globally in basins. That's what's so unusual about Alaska, both on the North Slope and here, is we have some of the huge fields in the Cook Inlet, for example, with 2 TCF at North Cook Inlet or Kenai Gas Field. They're way out on this distribution. You would not expect to see them in an exploration program. What you'd most likely see are the much smaller fields. So what are the different exploration play types that they did in when they did this modeling? You see on the top left there, that's the classic structure. That's what was drilled in the early 60s and found all the gas as a classic anticlinal structure. What hasn't been searched for primarily in the basin for gas, it certainly has for oil, are many other more complicated structural pictures, as you can see in the two diagrams on the right. And then finally, stratigraphic plays. That's where the sandstone or the reservoir actually pinches out or is truncated and covered by a later deposition of caprock. Those haven't been actually explored for in this basin. However, you need much higher quality seismic data to explore for these, and I'll show you in this next slide here. Oh, and one other slide, excuse me. Also within the fields, because we have many discontinuous reservoirs, and this was proved up in drilling at the Beluga River Gas Field over the last few years, is that there are sands that aren't tapped by the existing wells. There are sands out there that we don't even know exist. We have models that suggest they exist, but when they drill them, they'll be, some of these sands will actually be depleted. They've been the pressure has been depleted quite a bit. And when they hit those sands in an adjacent well, when they drill a new well, they'll see the same pressure. They know it's in communication. That's what the mass balance and decline curve analysis finds. But there's also sands that they hit that have virgin pressure, the original pressure, and are not in communication with other fields. Now, that is not a huge amount of gas, but they do exist. But here's a seismic line on the northwest side of the basin, and it shows the size of these structures that were drilled in the 1960s. Just for scale here, you see the scale on the left goes from 0 to 1,000. That's actually in two-way time. That's not a distance. What that represents is about 3,000 feet. And so from 0 to 1,000 means about 3,000 feet. And so the entire section here is about probably 2.5 miles of depth. And all of that stratigraphy, all of those lines in there represent different rock layers at depth. These are huge structures, and you could see them very easily. It'd be hard to miss this type of a structure. And in the 60s, when they saw that, of course, they got very excited. But what hasn't been looked for is the very subtle type plays in the foot walls of these folds, in the off structure type things that for exploration. Now, of course, that exploration is going to be more expensive because you have to shoot better seismic data, you have to do all of those different issues. So what's really been unexplored in the basin are the stratigraphically controlled plays, and I just have this diagram to kind of tell you how those work. Well, you have downlap, and I won't go into all the geologic jargon, but downlap and truncation, but sand bodies, reservoir bodies that are controlled stratigraphically, not in a big structure. So how do we know that they even exist in this basin? Why did they look at this in their analysis? Well, this is a seismic line in the northern part of the basin, same kind of scale. But you can see how the rock layers, all the different lines in this thing, pinch out. And if you look at it in detail, you can see all the same things that you saw on the previous slide, all of the onlap features, the truncation features, all of those type of features. So when USGS did their analysis, they looked at these seismic lines, and they say, okay, what would be a reasonable accumulation size in these types of traps? Exploration maturity, very important part of this whole story. This is actually the Wyoming that's laid on top of the North Slope for scale. However, the important part here is every one of those red dots that you see on the Wyoming map is an exploration well. The entire state's about 100,000 square miles. There's 70,000 total wells represented there. To put that into context, on the North Slope we have 500 exploration wells, and in Cook Inlet we have a little over 350. And so if you put that into what level of exploration has happened in the state of Alaska, it's minuscule in comparison to other resource-rich areas like Wyoming. What happens when you get that tight level of exploration? You can see through time here, this is a slide from Dave Hausnick, and it just shows you what the proven reserves have done through time in Wyoming. The initial, mostly conventional resources that were developed up through 1995, and then the additional of the unconventional, the tight gas sands, the coal bed methane plays, those types of things, and a dramatic increase in the proven reserves. So I won't go through this slide again. Paul has already gone through it in fair detail. And the key issue here is that, again, you can't to get to a proven reserve, we talked a lot about this technically recoverable resource, but to get to that point is a significant amount of work, a significant amount of investment that has to take place to go from the prospective resources that we've identified, this mean value of 19 TCF into a proven reserve. So what are going to be the hurdles for any of that kind of activity? Paul already talked about this, but of course one of them is the market. If you're going to spend $100 million on an exploration program, what are you going to be able to do with that commodity if you're lucky enough to find it? First, you have to get by the risk of just being able to find it. But secondly, where are you going to be able to sell it? And if you can only sell it for just a few weeks out of the coldest part of the winter, you're not going to make those types of investments. And so the market is an absolute key part of whether or not you're going to be exploring. Also, whether you have more than one commodity like oil and gas. Also, this is where the assessment was done by the USGS. You can see it's a nice, clean, open, big, huge basin. It's about 120, 150 miles in length. It's a relatively complex basin, but quite open with all the different areas. Now, this is what the assessment was done on, not curtailed by any other issue. However, if we take a look and put on top of that the land ownership, things become very, very complex. And so just having the geology is not everything in the picture. You must also be able to have surface access. You can see the federal acreage in brown, Siri acreage in blue. I won't go through those details, but the closures due to the Beluga habitat areas. And so surface access is another big thing that has a possibility to curtail exploration.
I appreciate this slide, by the way. It shows that you can't just walk out there. We can't just say, hey, here's a big Cook Inlet, send your rig out there and dig a hole. It's a lot more complex than doing that. I appreciate you guys having that slide.
Yep. So we just discussed this here just earlier on in the talk about, okay, what about those other field sizes? Are we going to be able to, or are those field sizes out there? I think if you take a look at what the activity is, has been, and some of the most recent discoveries, for example, Buccaneer with the 31.5 BCF of gas, as well as the Fury potential, that this is not; those are not reserves. They've not announced those types of reserves. They're suggesting an estimate of, I believe, it's 750 BCF now, but I'm not sure where that is. But if you take a look at that distribution, that field size distribution again, and what is missing, what the USGS came up with exactly predicts those type fields. The 35 BCF field is exactly what they predict. That's the most common occurrence, is that size of field. The huge fields, the big 2-3 TCF fields, the chances of those are very, very slim. Doesn't mean they're not out there, but it's very slim to run into those. It's a slim chance.
A lot more holes in the ground, basically.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, finally, I think another big thing is the gas price. I put this together here a couple years ago now, and I've been trying to keep track of this, but it's a very interesting slide. This just shows the price to the American consumer by state. And you can see Alaska's down to the very far right of that graph. And what it shows is that Alaska Alaska consumer has been paying the cheapest for gas probably for the last 30 years. And this was actually in 2007. And then the next slide will show is that shale gas came on down south. Very, very different story. What happened is, and I'll cover that up, what happened is that we are no longer actually paying the cheapest price for gas, and there's a number of other states that are close to that same amount. And then for shale gas production tripled during that time. Net imports were reduced by 11%, and that's from 2007 to 2010, and shale gas increased from 5 to 20% of the total volumes being used in the lower 48. And then finally, I just added the 2011 average gas prices. What's interesting, I think you guys probably know the Henry Hub was, I believe, right at $2 in the last few days, which is astounding. But you can see the yellow bars here that represent the 2011 gas prices, and it's actually leveled the playing field quite dramatically between what we pay for gas in Alaska and what Lower 48 pays. So in conclusion, I think probably the take-home points from the entire talk here is, you know, there's a lot of complexities in trying to understand resources in the basin. It's not a very, very simple single number. We can't do that. Is there a lot of gas? I think anybody that works this basin understands there's a lot of gas that has not been discovered. And however, it's very, very important that everyone understands that that is not as simple as just going out and finding it. There's a tremendous amount of work that has to go on to access that gas, but that the resource most likely is there, and we can't sit on a single number like a 19 TCF. It's much more complicated than that, and there's going to be a lot of economics and other things that come to play. To address that, of course, the state puts annual lease sales out. This is the lease sale will be coming up on May 16th of this year, and thank you.
Appreciate that. I'm sure there are additional questions, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you mentioned a couple of slides ago that the demand for gas, the market for gas, would have a positive effect if there was an increased market for gas on the amount of exploration. So if we, say, for example, built a pipeline to Fairbanks and North Pole, the refinery in that area, mm-hmm. would that amount of demand make much difference in the amount of exploration, do you think?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, I think it's very difficult, and I probably can't address that. I'm not a market person, but you know, any time there's an increase in demand, same thing goes with the pipeline that's the Donlin group are talking about. Anytime there's an increase in the demand, of course, there's a relatively constant market or constant place for you to sell gas. If the prospects are there, you most likely will see an increase in exploration to fill that need. But of course, it's a chicken and egg issue. You know, there's still a tremendous amount of risk associated with exploration. You know, we can't say that there's 19 TCFA out there because we don't know. It's an estimate. And so it's very much a risky system. And having a plan, having a backup plan, and I believe if you were to talk to the Donlin group, that they do have many different options that they're looking at, and they're keeping all of those options open because of the exploration risk. And of course, these guys are very, very familiar with exploration risk in the gold exploration business. But you have to keep those options open. So to say that, would it increase the expiration? I can't for sure say that.
One last question.
And when it comes to economics, just so the committee knows, I think PRA would probably be better on some of the economic questions, whereas in, of course, DNR, they've got the geological, they can look into the geological specifics, but please follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I remember getting a presentation in this committee a couple of years ago, and I don't know whether it was you or not, that said a field the size of Cook Inlet and the age of Cook Inlet would typically have had two or three times the number of wells that have been drilled would have been drilled by this time. And if that's true, if those wells had been drilled, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in right now, probably, would we?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, I'm not sure if I said that or not, but I do agree with the point there is that you will only get expiration if there's the market to sell into. What happened in the Cook Inlet in 1968, by 1968 we had found 8.2 trillion cubic feet of gas and we had essentially zero market. The market was developed at that time. The market was developed through the what turned into be the Agrium fertilizer plant as well as the LNG plant, plus the local market was developed. So that market was developed after the gas was found. And so the thought of going out and drilling for additional reserves when you had no market to sell into it, that's why we did not see that type of expiration, but we did see oil expiration.
Representative Sadler had a question.
Yeah, real briefly, to the chair, is Cook Inlet Basin analogous to any other basin in the world, whether it's mountainous or ocean, or is it unique? I'm just trying to draw any parallels to other basins.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler, through the chair. The Cook Inlet is not unique, but it is not a common basin either. It's called a four-arc basin. A four-arc basin. It means it's in front of the volcanic arc. And so you have volcanic detritus being shed into it. What is relatively unique about it is the thickness, up to 30,000 feet of stratigraphy that is all non-marine. That is very unusual. There are other non-marine basins out there. They're usually in tectonic settings where you have pull-apart basins, they call it. It's a strike-slip system. But it's not unique, but it is relatively unusual.
Okay. All right. Seeing no questions, I appreciate the presentation. Of course, we do have to move on to the next one, so we'll go ahead and allow that to take place. I appreciate both of you being here, and I'm sure there will probably be more questions that people will come up over time and may contact you on that. So thank you. This time, what I'd like is for Tom, I believe I see him back there, Tom, to go ahead and come on up. Of course, the Representative Sadler, Representative Lynn did have to step out for a few moments. They do have another committee where they've got, I think, a bill or two to pass. While Tom's getting set up here, I would like to make sure that I recognize that we have had several representatives that have been here for a period of time. We have Representative Millette and Representative Johansson that are currently with us. I know Representative Seaton, Representative Miller, Representative Chenault have all been here from time to time as well. And we want to make sure that if there's any questions that they have, that please feel free. We would love for you to join us up here or pass something up here and we can ask your questions for you. I want to make sure that they're engaged as well. I think we may need 1 minute just to get this set up, so we'll take a brief at ease as this gets set up on the computer, and then we'll be right back. All right, well, we'll come back to order. Tom, it's good to see you. Please put your name on the record and, of course, your affiliation, and begin your presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairman Pruitt. My name is Tom Walsh. I'm a managing partner of Petrotechnical Resource Alaska, an oil and gas consulting firm in Anchorage. And first of all, I'd like to thank the DNR team for filling in for me at the beginning. I showed up a little bit late. Really appreciate them stepping up and taking the first spot. I'll go through the PRA presentation. Wanted to start off by saying that the individual that is responsible for most of this work, Pete Stokes, is unavailable today and up on the North Slope testing some gas wells for Barrow, and so I'm filling in for him, but appreciate the work that Pete did on this, and we'll get right into our presentation. In 2009, the utility companies in South Central Alaska asked PRA to take on the study of remaining Cook Inlet gas supply in the existing fields to determine when they might foresee a shortfall in supply to meet their needs. And the study basically allowed the utility companies to understand the impact and drivers of drilling development activity, understand the results of the DNR study that was in progress at the time, and to help predict when they would need another source of gas in Cook Inlet, if at all. In 2012, we were asked to update that study, and I'll go through basically the initial story, the 2009 study, and then talk about the update to the study that was just completed. I will say I've had some questions this week about the report associated with that study, and that report has not been released yet. It's in review by the utility companies. So all I can share with you today is the slide set that I've that I'll be presenting. I wonder if would it be possible to get a glass of water, or
we can do that for you.
Perfect, thanks. So why do the utilities care about Cook Inlet gas supply? NSTAR is 100% reliant upon. Thank you very much. Reliant upon Cook Inlet gas, local gas, for their consumption. In 2009, they consumed 32.5 BCF of gas. Of the roughly 90 billion cubic feet of gas that was utilized for utilities in Cook Inlet, Chugach is 90% dependent on their generation at 26 BCF, and MLNP is 10.8. BCF of gas consumption. So they're extremely concerned about what the gas supply looks like going forward, what their commodity looks like in terms of ability to sell to the market. Yes.
Mr. Chair. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this is 2009 consumptions, and I know we in 2010 we really incentivized the Cook Inlet exploration, and it actually has gas storage now, and I think we heard earlier today that the gas storage might be operational as of today. You know, we did have those concerns back in 2009, and when you say that they have concerns, are you talking about back in 2009 having concerns, or are you talking about today having concerns?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, very good question. The update to the report done in 2009 was really to just update them on what the forecast looks like going forward. There was a big concern in 2009. That concern remains today. There is gas storage in the basin. There is gas storage that is operated by the producers, and now CINGSA is online flowing gas into the to the reservoir. But that really doesn't solve the problem, and you'll see as I go through the slides that you know, it doesn't really resolve the issue long term. Does that answer your question?
So far, yeah.
I think it's probably appropriate to make sure that we understand that they're putting gas inside the reservoir. It's not really fully online. That may be a clarification that's probably important to make at this point.
Okay.
Please, go ahead.
So where does the gas come from? We've seen from the DNR report the Cook Inlet Basin. The big players are Beluga River Unit in the north end of the basin, Trading Bay Unit, North Cook Inlet, Ninilchik, Kenai Unit, and then others at 15%. So we concentrated on producing assets, looking at what production is in place currently, the history of that production, and forecast forward what that production looks like into the future. So those are the primary fields that we were looking at. Now this is a 2009, slide number five, 2009 combined utility met and unmet gas demand. This has been updated, and we'll look at some more demand curves in the slide set, but you can see that the red portion of those bars is unmet gas demand. That's uncontracted demand that the utility companies see going forward. So there is a giant portion of the gas demand that is unmet in terms of contracts. And we'll see that that's a big driver for Cook Inlet gas development. As our DNR speakers pointed out, this is a slide from the 2009 DNR study. showing the historical production, and of course that historical production in blue was servicing not only the local demand in terms of heating and electrical usage, but also the export of LNG and the Agrium plant, both of which are done or winding down. But what we really looked at from the PRA perspective for the utility companies was the orange tranche here, which is the decline curve analysis. And again, as I just mentioned, we were looking at the existing fields and what is producing from those existing fields. So we haven't really looked at exploration potential or other things that might be out there on the horizon. Really looking at things that could be brought online in a very short period of time. So let me get into the objectives of the study and the results. The first bullet point, review DNR reserve analysis. The DNR took on a more comprehensive geologic study looking at what potential exists out in the basin in other what we call skins on the production profile from the previous slide, and looked at what potential might exist in the basin from the geologic perspective, where we were looking at very short-term supply options and what could be brought online from existing assets. But we were asked to review the DNR analysis and give the utility companies some perspective on what that analysis really meant. We looked at the deliverability of Cook Inlet gas wells drilled from 2001 to 2009 and the decline curve analysis, looking at how rapidly those wells have declined to create a forecast going forward. And looking at well history of production is a very standard means of looking at what fields would produce going forward. So from that information, we forecast the deliverability of existing and future gas wells. So looking at the existing well set, what could they produce going forward? And if additional wells were drilled, what could we expect to recover from those wells? And then finally, analyze the timing required for delivery of non-Cook Inlet gas sources. And we've all heard the discussions revolving around LNG import or gas pipeline from the North Slope, but some means of bringing gas to Cook Inlet Basin to supply the necessary gas for the utility companies to continue to operate.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we used to have an Agrium plant down there, and we also had we were exporting gas at one time. In your analysis, does it talk about how much is now available for consumers in Alaska based on those two projects no longer in operation?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, it does. We look at the utility companies actually supplied us with the demand curves going forward. And you'll see that there is a decline in that demand in the 2012-2013 time frame with curtailment of export of LNG and of course the Agrium plant has closed, and so that's behind us now. But the demand curves going forward do recognize those changes in demand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the study methodology, we looked at field-level decline curve analysis for most of the fields that I pointed out on the on a previous slide. And field-level decline curve analysis basically goes to the AOGCC records of production for gas fields, looks at what those fields have produced on an annual basis, and projects forward then from that analysis what those fields are capable of producing and what their remaining reserves are. We did individual well decline curve analysis on the five largest fields, those would be the major fields that are producing in the basin. We looked at individual well decline curves to get a better feel for what new wells would do in terms of if you brought on new wells, if you drilled new wells, what would you expect to get from those wells? From that, we calculated new well initial production decline through time. So you look at those fields and the decline curve analysis from the individual wells, and you predict what a new well would do, and if you drill a certain number of wells, what would those wells contribute to future production in the basin. And really what that does is it's based on the existing assets. Again, like I say, we're not looking at exploration, production from exploration here. We're looking at the existing assets. And what it really is acceleration of production. You know from the decline curve analysis from those fields that you have a certain volume of gas remaining in those fields, and putting new straws in the field represented by new wells being drilled is just accelerating that production. So that's really the bottom line of what the PRA study did, was look at acceleration potential. If we started drilling more wells, how long could we continue to operate our utilities without needing to import gas? The next bullet, calculate activity required to meet future demand. So how many wells do we need to be drilling per year going forward to continue to operate our utilities? We also looked at the plans of the operating companies, the plans of development for each field, which talks about each plan of development that is reported each year to the state of Alaska, deals with what development might occur in each field each year. So we looked at those, and that gives you basically a one-year forecast of what the operators might be doing going forward. And then finally, we looked at the business drivers and what is really driving the producers to drill more wells and spend more money in Cook Inlet Basin. So the two periods that we separated out, we looked at 2001 to 2009, and we looked at 2007 to 2009. And the reason to split those out was to really look at if there were changes in the amount of gas discovered per well in those periods of time and the number of wells completed and so forth. So in 2001 to 2009, there were 128 gas wells drilled, and of those 128, 105 of them were completed. That means that 23 of those wells were not completed. They were for some reason determined not to be economic, and they weren't completed. But of those 105 wells that were completed, the initial production was an average of 3.6 million cubic feet a day. So looking at 2007 to 2009, there were 34 wells drilled in that period of time. All 34 were completed as gas production wells. And the average production from those wells was 3.1 million cubic feet per day. And the importance of that is that as you continue to drill wells in a mature basin, you would expect to get less gas out of each well. You're looking at a declining production base, and so we wanted to get a handle on what that level of decline was from year to year, and that weighs into our analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was just thinking about the jack-up rigs that are going to be drilling in areas that actually haven't been producing. Mm-hmm. And so they would not be subject to this decline curve because they're not currently being drilled or they're not currently producing. Is that correct?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, that is correct. They were not involved in this analysis. Those wells that could be brought online due to exploration success would be separate from this and might come in at much higher numbers.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I understand this chart, I don't know why it was split up between 2001 and 2009, having an 8 or 9 year period there, and then 2007, 2009. But is this all, you mentioned earlier in the previous slide that we're drilling in existing fields, just new straws, if you will. Are these the new straws? I mean, the new straws going into existing fields, or is this beyond the existing fields?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, these are what I refer to as new straws going into existing fields, producing fields. And now some of these represent production from intervals that may not have been producing before. There may be wells in this mix that that intersect layers of sediment that have not been produced at all. And so there may be what we refer to as virgin pressures, which would be, you know, they have not been produced at all. Most of these wells are infill wells that are into existing producing zones.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. And then on one of your slides, you have the five. So these are the five majors. And then you have one that others, and others is producing about 15%. So that doesn't include the others that are existing. Are we just referring to the five major ones?
It does include the others. We just didn't go through them by name.
Okay. So if I make sure I understand, so this is all existing fields, not just the five majors.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. And really, the previous slide that shows the breakout between 2001 to 2009 and 2007 to 2009 was really kind of a sensitivity to determine if there was a change. And the current slide that I'm showing here, slide number 11, Cook Inlet Gas Development, shows basically the initial production from wells that have been drilled in that time period. And you can see the trend that is shown here is fairly clear. I mean, the correlation is not great. It's not there is a bit of scatter, but you can certainly see that going from 2001 to 2009, there is a downward trend in the number of cubic feet of gas that each well is defining. And again, excuse me, as I say, you would expect that in a mature asset or a mature basin to see the level of production or the level of reserves go down as you drill new wells. That's a key factor in our analysis, and our ability to project forward is dependent on what we would expect from new wells. The next slide, slide number 12, Cook Inlet gas production forecast from decline curve analysis, compares what the DNR study showed from their decline curve analysis as compared to the PRA study. And in general, we're quite close, I think, in terms of decline curve analysis for the basin. There's not anything really remarkable here. I think we agreed very closely with the DNR in terms of what was expected to be produced from the existing assets in Cook Inlet Basin. The PRA study had a little bit more production early on and less later on, but in general, the amount of gas remaining was very consistent between the two studies. I think in general, I will say also that we found that we didn't really have any discrepancies between the two studies. The DNR study, as I pointed out earlier, had more of a geologic focus, as ours had more of a commercial focus and a near-term production capability focus. So I think in general we agreed very closely. And basically what we both found in that 2009 study, PRA study, and the DNR study was that in 2013, from decline curve analysis, there was an issue with supply meeting demand in the 2013 timeframe, so a year from now. The PRA study concludes significant development activity is required, and the DNR study looked more at, you know, what potential might be out there. We looked at really how many straws would it take to keep production at a level that the utility companies could keep operating at their current pace. This is slide 14 is annual supply and demand, and the green curve is the demand forecast, which is roughly, you know, right around 90 BCF a year. And the blue curve is the supply forecast from the decline curve analysis. And as you can see, when those two curves cross in 2013, supply no longer meets demand. And that is that's exactly what the utility companies were looking for, is when will local supply no longer meet their demand forecast. The demand forecast, as I mentioned earlier, goes from little south of 130 BCF a year in the 2008-2009 period, drops off significantly in 2011. And that really reflects the slowdown in LNG export and the Agrium plant closure. There was quite a large amount of gas available at that time. That gas supply no longer is available, and so those two activities the changes in those activities have reflected the lack of gas supply. But where it really gets critical is when the blue curve crosses the green curve here, or the green boxes, and when we no longer can meet demand with local supply of gas. And, of course, that expands going forward to the forecast period of 2020 here. I think a key point to make on this slide is the level of demand being about 90 BCF a year. That is not an awful lot of gas. The market is very small in South Central Alaska. And so to supply that local market, it's basically one of the business drivers is, you know, how big is your market? And for companies like ConocoPhillips and Marathon and Chevron and other companies, that's not a huge market, and it's not a big chip in their portfolio. So that's a key point here, and one of the key drivers that we found is, you know, if you can create a larger market, you'll attract more interest. There are two things that drive that market. One is the cost of the commodity, and the other is how big is the market, how much can you sell.
And I want to jump ahead in case you do discuss it, but the LNG export facility, of course, it's shutting down. That potentially has an impact, I'm estimating, on the demand. And I guess one of the other, I want to kind of stem from that, if we have that export market out there, my concern is, are we having to lose jobs? Are we having to get away from that just to fill our own supply? And will that have an impact on the amount of production or the amount of exploration that takes place? And I think you may get into that. I've gone through the slides, but I think you may get into it. So I don't want to jump ahead because I think you're still dealing with 2009. But, is that something that you can answer now or you want to wait to answer?
Chairman Pruitt, that's a great question. I think and I will touch upon it. It's reflected in the demand curves going forward that we've updated. But it is a key point that in the past, the LNG export has been, it's almost filled the niche of gas storage in terms of keeping gas wells flowing during the period of time that there's not a demand in South Central Alaska. So it has been very beneficial, I think, to the operators of the assets to be able to keep those wells going and not shut them in. The simple fact is now that we just don't have the supply to be exporting. My feeling is that there will be an opportunity for further gas export in the future, and the fact that we have a 90 BCF market locally kind of precludes precludes one of the big business drivers is volume of gas that you can sell to the market. And so LNG export is a great anchor tenant for marketing gas if you have the gas to market. So there it's It's something that has filled a very significant niche in the past. There's simply no gas to export at this point. Hopefully the gas that is available during the summer will go into gas storage. And in the future, if we're successful at these exploration efforts, hopefully in the future there will be another opportunity for gas export.
Thank you.
So, but we will talk a bit about the demand curve and where that drops out.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it looks like from this supply curve, it's the same as all the other decline curves. I mean, you're always going to have a field, and it's always going to be very consistent on its decline. And I know that this study does not take into effect any new wells, except for up to 2009. But how many wells have been discovered from 2009 to 2012 that we may want to look in the future to see how that how the supply and demand curve will be affected?
Representative, talk through the chair. We will get to that slide. I don't want to quote it off the top of my head, but we do show that in terms of the wells that have been drilled since 2009 and what their benefit to production has been. So okay. We're heading that direction.
And then if I may, Mr. Chair, I know that earlier we had a map of Wyoming put over the North Slope, and it showed 70,000 wells being drilled with all those little red dots compared to 500 wells being drilled up on the North Slope and only 350 in the Cook Inlet. And so I know that we had testimony back in 2009 with the Energy Committee with Armstrong, and Armstrong was talking about how the Cook Inlet fields is very typical of other fields around elsewhere, and how there is more gas down there, and they're asking for us to incentivize and allow them the opportunity to go actually explore for gas, because prior to that we were only exploring for oil and finding gas along the way. And so we've made those steps. So when we show that Wyoming field, is that a field that's typically characteristic of what we would have in the Cook Inlet area? Is that the reason why? And I'm sorry, I should have probably asked that question a little bit earlier. But you being the expert and knowing, being the consultant, are you able to answer that question?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, that is a bit outside the scope of my presentation, but what I will say is that the major difference is a link to market between Alaska Cook Inlet gas and Wyoming gas. And you know, that is good and bad. Obviously, being able to tie into pipelines in the lower 48 and having a direct link to the market is great when the commodity is somewhat limited. Well, as we heard earlier, the commodity price is $2 an MCF in the lower 48 right now, so there's too much gas for the market that exists down there. So we're completely disassociated with lower 48 gas in terms of our market, and we have a very limited market. We don't have a very strong business driver for large companies to come in and explore and develop for gas, and that is one of the issues that we did look at in our study, is what is driving the market. So that's what I would say, is that I think that what the state has done in terms of incentivizing Cook Inlet exploration and production is tremendous, and it has brought in, you know, potentially two jackup rigs. So we are moving in the right direction in terms of activity in Cook Inlet Basin through those actions, and I think that speaks very highly of what the state has done in terms of incentivizing activity. The big issue is our market and what is driving the market and what will drive the market for big discoveries in Cook Inlet Basin.
Okay, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Make it very quick, we'll hold the remaining questions after this follow up to the end, so that we can make sure that we present the
okay. And I understand there's the marketing aspect, but I was just looking at the supply aspect, seeing what's available out there. That's what I was getting at. So, and I understand there's market differences between Wyoming and Alaska. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to figure out the characteristic of the field. Okay. And if you want, I can just save that question for later, and I'll be able to ask the DNR group later on. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. The scenario in the 2009 study, if current trends in drilling success rates continue, an estimated 185 new wells must be drilled before 2020 to basically meet the demand requirements. And
I want to clarify, it says to meet utility needs. We're only talking about utility.
Right. Yes, we are talking about just utility needs. Yes, thank you. So slide number 16 shows the PRA forecast, and this is basically looking at the demand and supply if we see the type of development and wells drilled that will meet the demand curve. This is basically what we're trying to do here is say, okay, what do you need to do to match supply with demand? And the next slide, 17, shows the number of wells that must be drilled between 2011 and 2019. And this is not by any means the exact number per year. What it shows, though, is that in 2010, 2011, we aren't showing any wells being drilled there. And we're playing catch-up in the years to come after that. And in order to meet the demand, you've got to drill, I think it's an average of 13.6 wells a year.
And there were none drilled between 2010 and
2011? There were wells drilled, and we'll talk about that in the update. Yes, thank you. So looking at the gas development costs, we looked at the estimated cost of drilling and development in the past decade, and that number for 10 years of development from what we could gather was about $1 to $1.2 billion of investment to bring on the wells into production that had been drilled in that period of time. So going forward, our estimate was $1.9 to $2.8 billion for the next 10-year period. And the thought there is that that bringing on those new wells and that new production at that cost will increase the cost of natural gas locally. Study findings, near-term drilling must be successful or gas resource from outside the Cook Inlet could be required as early as 2013. Again, this is the 2009 study, so we'll talk about the updates. But if drilling doesn't keep pace, the only viable option really that could meet that demand in the short term is LNG imports. And when I presented this 3 years ago to the RDC, it was not comfortable for me to be saying that we were going to be importing gas to a resource-rich state. But that is really the bottom line. There's no other means of filling that demand in the short term that we've got. And that LNG import is really being looked at as kind of a temporary fix. I mean, we do have gas in Cook Inlet. The USGS has stated that there's gas available. The DNR has shown that there is gas available. It's just a matter of bringing it online in the right time frame to meet the utility demands. And I think NSTAR is obviously in a critical situation that they sell gas to the local market, and if they don't have gas, they're hurting for business. So that's obviously why they're very, very interested in this. So this 2009 summary slide just shows the gap between the demand curve and the supply curve as we forecast it. And again, that forecast based on decline curve analysis is very much in agreement with the decline curve analysis of the DNR. There is a gap there, and we calculated the monetary requirement of $1.9 to $2.8 billion investment to keep things going for that next 10 years.
And just to clarify, that $1.9 to $2.8 billion is only to meet the supply of the utilities. It does not include the LNG export. It does not include Fairbanks, Donlin Creek, any other concept that's out there, just the utilities supplies that they'll need, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, so this slide actually, I believe, is from the DNR study, and we're looking at the needs to fill the requirement up to 2018, 2020, and really just stating that you know, without the investment going forward, there is a lack of supply locally, and there is a need for additional input of gas to fulfill our requirements. So the 2012 update, PRA was asked to update the 2009 study this year and basically look at, you know, what wells had been drilled, what are the results of that drilling program, that drilling campaign in the last 3 years, and then forecast again where we might see a shortfall. And what we've seen is that there has been drilling activity in that period of time, and there have been compressors brought online to produce gas that was not available to the market prior to that time. So the we looked at supply and demand again, and the utility companies provided us with the demand curves, the demand forecasts. You can see that in the upper chart here, the 2009 study is reflected in the blue color line, and the 2012 study is in red. And so there is a bump in production and in supply that does push us out another year, basically. And that is due to the drilling activity and to the compression that's been brought online, so investment in the basin. The demand forecast is slightly lower than in 2009, so this kind of helps to meet that gap. And you'll see the dip in 2012-13 that shows the curtailment of LNG export and then a big jump in demand in 2019 with Donlin Creek coming on. And Donlin Creek is now part of the partnership that is looking at gas supply in the basin. The material increases in the supply side were in the Beluga River field, Trading Bay, and in Ilchik units where new wells have been drilled, new production has been brought on through those wells, and compression has been added. And compression basically just allows you to produce fields that aren't really flowing to the surface on their own very effectively anymore and bring them up to pipeline pressure where you can utilize that production. So two redrills in Beluga River field, two new wells in Ilchik, and four new wells at Trading Bay unit. So there has been activity that has fed into the supply side of the equation. The new completions between November of 2009 and October of 2010, there were five new completions that brought on 18.5 million cubic feet of gas. And then between November 10th and October 11th, there are six new completions that brought on 9.9 million cubic feet of gas a day. So significant new wells brought into the equation, and the bottom line is that those push out our forecast to 2014 when we have the supply and demand crossing. We talked about LNG. There are expected to be 3 to 4 cargoes in 2012, and then that will be curtailed in our forecast. Chugach has a new plant that's created some tremendous efficiencies. That's included in the forecast. And Homer Electric and Matanuska Electric have demands that are coming into play that were not considered in the 2009 study. And then we also look at the field fuel and flare of 10.5 BCF a year. Just to run these fields, you burn gas to produce the gas. And then I mentioned Donlin Creek starting up in 2019. So the supply-demand and shortfall with the supply forecast from annual average, the shortfall is now predicted to be 2014. So it pushed it out basically a year. And again, you can see the shortfall bars on here in 2014 showing a 7.3 BCF per year shortfall with the supply and demand curves crossing in 2014. We also looked at some sensitivities for additional wells being drilled in the next 10 years. And one of those sensitivities was looking at 3 to 4 new wells drilled each year, resulting in 10 million cubic feet of gas a day, added each year from 2012 to 2019. So kind of keeping pace with a 3 to 4 well drilling program going forward, and the there still is a shortfall in 2014. It doesn't really resolve the issue. If we look at 6 to 8 new wells per year going forward, it pushes the shortfall out to 2015. So the bottom, and what you'll see here is the demand curve is staying the same on these slides, but the supply curve is flattening out with new production coming on. The issue here is that somewhere between 2014 and 2015, we have a shortfall that is unmet with local supply.
I think one of the things I think is probably important, because we talk a lot about storage, but you're solely talking about the fact that over annually, we won't be able to pull up enough to provide for what we need annually. So even if we have storage that'll help us in the peak periods, it's not going to help the fact that we're just not going to have enough gas to meet the annual demand.
Correct. Yes. Chairman Pruitt, that's a good point. What we have assumed in our analysis is perfect storage, which means that we're looking at annual averages of production. So what if you peel the layers off and look in more detail, what you're really looking at is the coldest day of the year in South Central Alaska. Can you meet that demand?
Right.
We're looking at annual averages and saying in 2014, 2015, we will not be able to meet that demand. Now, every year, for the past few years, we've come very close to not meeting demand on the short-term basis for coldest day of the year. So that's an issue that we aren't really addressing here. But storage is believed or is treated as perfect storage, and we're just looking at annual averages for our study.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking back at slide number 29, and you're assuming 6 to 8 new wells a year. And we heard earlier that they're projecting 10 to 12 wells this year. And some of these companies are just now getting their drill rigs up here. And so we might actually see even more wells than that drilled in future years. So isn't there a good chance that we'd be pushing out the shortfall several years, maybe out to 2018?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, there is significant activity in the basin. There has been this year, and there is certainly the expectation with potentially 2 jackup rigs coming in that there will be more activity. Again, that's exploration activity that is the fruits of that activity are a long way out. They can't immediately bring on that production. So that really doesn't play into this 2014-2015 sensitivity. For the long term, if someone discovers a multi TCF gas field in Cook Inlet and it's commercial and can be brought online, that will help the local market. It would basically swamp the local market, and you'd have to have export of that gas really to keep the operator content with their returns. But what we're looking at is really just the development activity in existing assets, and we're not seeing the type of activity that we had forecast needs to be done to keep up with the demand curve. So we had predicted in 2009 that we need 13.6 wells a year, and we're really not seeing that type of activity. So the short answer to what does the update of this study represent, it represents that we have not met the forecast that we felt in terms of development needed to be the investment that needs to be made, and we're basically falling behind. But we have the demand curve is slightly lower than before, and we have had some wells that have been very successful in existing assets.
Jackup rigs and those and some of that new stuff, that was encouragement to develop assets that we really hadn't explored yet, correct? I mean, these are dealing with things that we have a fairly good understanding that if we put a hole in the ground, we're going to get some sort of gas. Our encouragement was to develop with the jackup rigs and some of those other credits, so was to encourage the development outside of those areas. So it's really not something that I think at this point we can count on, right? I mean, we're encouraging it. We want to see it. But we're not talking about stuff that we, as a utility, I guess, as the ones that asked for this can say, yeah, we feel comfortable on saying that's going to supply our needs into the future. Is that?
That's correct, Chairman Pruitt. The for the short-term demand that we're looking at, those activities are beyond our window that we're really looking at here. I think that you know, we would all like to see activities increased in Cook Inlet Basin, and we would like to see the available gas developed and produced. But it's not going to help the utility companies in the next 2 to 3 years. Is the bottom line.
And I know you have one more slide, and then we've got a couple questions. Okay. I'll let you finish your last couple slides here, and then let you.
Okay. Thank you. The existing fields with initial year shortfall amount of 7.3, these are the last three slides I went through, just showing that basically if you just continue on with the development or production from the existing fields as they are, we're going to see that shortfall in 2014, and the shortfall will be about 7.3 BCF a year. And then if we add 10 million standard cubic feet a day with new wells, going forward, the initial shortfall in 2014 would be 1 BCF, but we still see the shortfall in 2014. We still need another source of gas, or we've all got to tighten our belts and turn down our thermostats. So existing fields plus annual addition of average of 20 million cubic feet a day from new wells basically pushes us out to the horizon of 2015. So the bottom line here, and that represents a shortfall of 1.6 BCF of gas in that first year where we don't meet demand. The bottom line here is that we have a very near-term problem that we don't have local supply to meet demand, and we've got to do something about it. And that was really the intent of the study by the utility companies, saying, when are we going to run out of gas? And between our study and the DNR study, I think there's fairly good agreement that there is a shortfall in the 2013 to 2015 time period now. The conclusion here is that absent major new large discoveries that can be brought online in 1 to 2 years, current pace of development will mean a shortfall in 2014 to 2015. So the timeline is just not there to turn something around and bring it online in 1 to 2 years from the exploration activity that's occurring in the basin. The incentives, I think, are working. We've got lots of activity occurring, but it's beyond the time horizon when we're going to fall short of gas supply.
So even if some of the new development that we're encouraging with our tax credits, the jackup rigs, even if they're able to find something major, we're talking about it takes more than 1 to 2 years to get that to a point where we'd be able to utilize it. Therefore, meaning even if they're successful, we're going to have a shortfall that we're going to have to stem in some manners.
Chairman Pruitt, that's absolutely correct. Yes, we have a short-term need that can't be met with that activity.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tuck had a question earlier, and then Representative Sather.
Yeah, real quick. The 185 wells you were referring to earlier, those are the ones that are in existing known fields. Is that correct? That's not new exploration or anything?
That is correct. Okay. Representative Tuck, through the chair.
And the same thing with the conclusions. We're talking about the five majors plus the others that are there. And we're talking about new straws in existing fields. We're not talking about new exploration. So when we look at these forecasts, we're talking about what's known. And in what's known, if we don't mind going back to slide 6, we have the red, orange, green, yellow, and gray forecasts. And my understanding is the green bar is the one that is known fields, right? And we even have it at 353 billion cubic feet increments with four fields being in parentheses. But you were going off the orange mark with your forecast. Is that correct?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, what our study really represents is closest to the orange tranche there that is existing producing assets. And the other skins that are shown on this production profile are things that could be in the case of the green category. Those are reserves that the DNR felt could be brought on in existing assets, but geologic pay that really hasn't been developed. I guess that would be an area that we would probably have some disagreement in terms of how big that tranche is and where it's really going to come from. I can say that the operating companies have aggressively gone after everything that is available in their existing assets, and what's really driving them is contracts and you know where they can sell the gas, but they have very aggressively pursued any opportunities to produce more gas from existing assets at this point.
If I remember the conversation from DNR, the green is basically the difference between what the geologists say and what the engineers say. And I think the engineers are kind of the ones turning the heads of the guys with the pocketbooks, right? Is that kind of a more simple way to bring that down?
Chairman Pruitt, that is a simple way to put it. I think I'm a geophysicist. I would say that there is more gas out there in Cook Inlet. It's just a matter of can you bring it online quick enough to meet this demand issue, and it's further out on the horizon.
And a cost that makes sense.
And at a cost that makes sense, exactly.
But the green fields are known fields.
I think you're right on that. I think that
they are known fields, and if we're going to put in new straws, we probably want to start with the known fields first.
As long as it makes sense to economically, I think that's the key factor on that. That's the difference there. But I mean, it's a good point, Representative Sadler. And I don't mean to cut you off. We just have time, so I'll jump to Representative Sadler,
thanks.
And then Representative Peterson has something after.
Two quick related questions, and forgive me if they were covered while I was gone. But through the chair, with the relatively low prices of gas, how would you characterize the economic impetus for more drilling? Obviously, there's demand for us, but is it economically remunerative for companies to be drilling in Cook Inlet these days?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think that one of the findings that we have come up with in our study, one of the business drivers is obviously cost, the cost of the commodity. And what we have really supported is the idea that you've got to somehow tie this. We have a distinct market. We have a very local, small market, and we're trying to determine what is really the driver for operators to drill new wells and spend money in that market. Obviously, if the cost of the commodity is higher, that will incentivize more development and more drilling. We can't really grow our market. It's kind of a chicken and egg. We can't grow the market. We can't use export of LNG to grow the market when we don't have the supply to do it. So somehow we've got to get the price of the commodity out there that's attractive to get more drilling going. And as you guys know, there've been a lot of changes recently in the operatorship of Cook Inlet assets. So there's kind of a new mix there.
And one more question. Given I know there's a large demand for manpower and equipment in other places, Lower 48, and so forth, can we assume that we'll always be getting the same quality of companies, exploration drilling companies in Cook Inlet? And would that factor into the estimates of how much production would come from whatever drilling production we have?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's a very good question. There has been a tremendous draw by the Lower 48 for manpower and for talent. We've seen a lot of people going outside to work on big projects in the Lower 48, the shale projects in particular. There is an issue. There's always the global competition for these companies to operate, and then now there's the competition for just the people. And in my business, in the consulting business, we're seeing that strong pull of talent out of the state of Alaska. So that will be a factor, I think. It's not something that we've really addressed in this study, but it is a key factor.
So we can't assume that we have the same rate of success and effective, efficient drilling production.
That's probably the right assumption to make, is that we can't assume going forward that we'll have that same success rate. It could turn the other way. We could bring in independents that are very aggressive and want to go after that gas market, but there's no way to predict.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to be fast on this.
I haven't gone
on slide five. We were looking at the unmet demand in the gas supply. I believe that this is a 2009 chart. I believe there's some contracts that are have been approved and that are in the process of being looked at by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Are they're not included on this, I don't assume.
Representative Peterson, through the chair, no, they are not. This is a 2009 slide, and those have not been represented.
Okay. And also, we actually do, since we created the Cook Inlet Stampede Bill, I guess we could call it, giving 70% credits in some instances for reimbursement of drilling costs, wouldn't you assume that we may even draw more companies to explore Cook Inlet, especially since some of the shale gas and the Lower 48 is only getting about $2 a thousand cubic feet?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, it certainly, I think the stampede reference is well taken. But there really hasn't been a stampede. I mean, there are two companies that are bringing up jackup rigs, and now they're competing against each other to get drilling done. There has not been a tremendous influx of new companies that have come, and I was a bit surprised by that, to tell you the truth, that there wasn't more immediate activity that basically came in to take the opportunity to exercise those incentives.
Okay. Thanks.
I'll just have one last question. Even with the additional potential that could come online, of course, the $1.9 to $2.8 billion that you said we'd potentially have to put into our current the current fields to get to our demand, in your professional opinion, do you see the cost of gas remaining the same? Or should we as South Central consumers expect to see, even with all the, you know, even with every meeting all the points that that we've got and drilling all the wells, are we probably looking at an incremental increase in the gas supply cost to South Central?
Chairman Pruitt, I would say that in my professional opinion, we can certainly expect gas commodity prices to go up, and what we have been suggesting is that you benchmark against other realistic opportunities to bring gas to Cook Inlet. And one is a pipeline from the North Slope to Cook Inlet, and another is LNG import. And those two benchmarks are significantly higher than what we're paying for natural gas right now. Those two benchmarks, and just, you know, the consideration of those two benchmarks, will have the impact of incentivizing Cook Inlet exploration and development, I believe, because companies that are looking to invest in Cook Inlet Basin are going to look at it and say, well, this is what we're now competing against. They're not competing against $2 gas in the Lower 48 because we're not connected to the hubs down there. So, yes, in my view, the gas commodity price is definitely going to go up.
All right, I appreciate that. Well, being that we do have to get to the floor, I know there's a lot of questions still in people's minds. Feel free. I'm sure that Tom's probably available, or you can send them through me, and I can send them to Tom, and maybe it might be something that the whole committee would want to get the answers to. But we'll make sure that we keep the opportunity for everyone to ask those questions available. So with that, it is looks like about 9:07. So about 2 hours again. So I appreciate you being here, Tom, DNR, and we're adjourned.